Chapter 4. Then the plane came and went. We sank back, spent by our futile effort to attract the pilot. Tony and I were facing each other from the opposite sides of the raft. Jean sat on the after thwart. He was still gazing hopefully after the speeding scout, now rapidly becoming smaller. Tony was watching me. For a moment, my heart was in the lowest possible depths. I can quote exactly what I said. "Boys, there goes our one and only chance," for Tony weeks later recalled to me every word. With that single statement, I almost killed the hope in Tony's game soul, for the time being. He did not realize then that I still had cards to play. Jean was by no means dispirited. "Shucks, maybe he saw us and is going back for help," he suggested confidently. He was enthusiastic all day. He expected any minute to see a destroyer or another plane. I had made one slip and was careful not to make another, so I agreed heartily with Jean and never mentioned what was in my mind. All that day I lied cheerfully and let the boys think we had a good chance to be rescued. Secretly, I was taking stock of our position with a view to sailing that tiny raft, without oars or sails, to the nearest friendly island. Our situation was complicated by the possibility that certain islands in the vicinity might now be in the possession of the Japanese. I had no illusions as to what would happen to us all if we fell into the hands of enemies on some remote atoll. Despite his low spirits at the moment, the tenacity for life in Tony's staunch Polish nature asserted itself quickly, and he began to consider practical means of making our situation better. He paid no more attention to the sky, but silently searched in the inside of the raft with his eyes. He began rummaging in the oar pocket. "Ah," he exclaimed with satisfaction. He held a mirror of stainless steel, placed in the oar pocket, obviously as a heliographic signaling device. For the rest of the day, Tony practiced with the mirror, flashing it in the sun so he would know how to use it if the occasion arose. Tony liked anything that required him to use his hands. He had taken a mechanics course in high school, and after the war, when he leaves the Navy, he hopes to work in a machine factory. The newspaper accounts of our voyage only mentioned Tony briefly as Anthony J. Pastula, 24, Aviation Ordnance Man Second Class of 149 Ellenwood Avenue, Youngstown, Ohio. The news was in the adventure, not the men, but men make adventure just as much as adventure makes men. Through coming to know Tony in the long days and nights ahead, I obtained a better understanding of these sons of foreigners, who form such a large percentage of the young men who sail our ships and planes and man our guns. Tony's parents came from Poland. Neither his father nor his mother speaks English at home. His father is a landscape gardener, now caretaker of an estate in Youngstown, which belongs to a prominent newspaper publisher there. Tony helped his father, spare time and summers, until he got tired of depending on the folks and joined the Navy. Before that, he had been in the Civilian Conservation Corps. Gene Aldrich was a CCC boy, too. Neither he nor Tony had any background of the sea. I, of course, had long training on the sea, which was to stand me in good stead here, but my business now is flying. Tony, like many others, joined the Navy in 1939 because he believed his country would soon be at war. Previous to that, his contacts with the military had been with the Army. Among his jobs in the CCC during his two hitches of 1937 and 1938 was driving Army convoy trucks. Tony had a stern independence in his nature which brought him steeply around two milestones in his young life. One was when he left school. "This course, I was doing all right, see," Tony explained. "I didn't expect no A, but I thought I ought to get a B or anyways a C, and that would have been all right. I never cared about making the best marks in school, see, long as I learned this stuff. Well, I had that course down good, and when I got that report card and saw that big shiny F, I just said..." Well, never mind what he said. He just walked out of that senior high school and never went back. The other crisis concerned religion. Tony had been brought up in the Catholic faith. The only prayers he knew were in Polish. We all did some praying on this trip, first because it worked a couple of times and we were willing to keep trying again, and later because it gave us something regular to do. In fact, our prayer meeting was to become the high spot of our evenings. Tony was good-humored about religion. "I quit, see? This night I was standing around the corner with the fellas, and this preacher comes along, and I don't pay much attention. And then this preacher goes and talks about me because I don't tip my cap to him. Made me sore." So Tony, disgusted, would have nothing more to do with formal religion. Aldrich, on the other hand, had a deep streak of piety. His brother was a preacher. It was Gene who suggested our prayer meetings. Gene is more of a farm boy. His home is in Sykeston, Missouri. He is younger than Tony, just 22, and had been in the Navy only 15 months. He had put in some time in the CCC as a cook, and for our meals, as we became really hungry, he cooked us many hypothetical dinners, with Tony, who for a time had been a sandwich man in the seas, offering suggestions. Before the trip was over, Gene was talking seriously about trying for a transfer to the Navy Cook's Department, and I think he will. Cooking played a large part in Gene's early life. His father was a railroader, a section foreman, and Gene recalled that it used to be a favorite stunt of his and his father's to go out about 4 o'clock in the morning to shoot squirrels for their breakfast. It seems there are a lot of squirrels in Missouri. One of Gene's concerns on the trip was a $5,000 life insurance policy he had taken in favor of his mother. He wondered if she had been able to get it yet. Money was scarce around Gene's home. Gene joined the Navy after finding that he didn't like the CCC. The spirit of adventure got him, and he thought he could do better and get more schooling in the Navy. He had had 1 year of high school, working to put himself through. Talking it over, Gene shook his head quizzically. "If Mother could see me now." Well, she wouldn't have liked the look of it. The wind this morning was in the southeast, blowing us toward a group of islands which we presumed to be deserted. However, we thought the Japanese might have put some men there, so we were not enthusiastic about making these islands on that account. I was concerned at once about learning to control the raft, figuring out ways and means of working toward the larger islands that I knew to be in friendly hands. The geography of this part of the Pacific was far from a mystery to me. Every day in the ready room, I had studied the charts and had a mental picture of where every island was, so I knew from the beginning just where I wanted to go. I had no intention of letting that raft drift aimlessly, guided only by the shifting winds. We were without rudder, oars, or canvas, but still I was determined to sail that raft if I could. And I maintain that I did sail it. I worked like the devil to sail it, and I resent anyone saying we drifted. Controlling our craft's progress was my first concern, because while we were entirely without food or water, there was nothing any of us could do about this but wait for the Lord to send us a shower and bring some food where we could catch it. I figured the Lord would help those who helped themselves, so I set out immediately to take every bit of advantage that I could of the few materials available to me. The wind blew up to a fresh breeze of about 12 knots, and I spent most of the first day observing how our boat was going to act. I knew from the previous experiences both of myself and of several shipmates who had tried these boats in the water that, being flat and smooth-bottomed, the raft would sail along smartly in the wind. It soon became apparent that the raft was not only responding satisfactorily to the push of the wind, but that she had no tendency to yaw. She remained steadily lengthwise of the trough of the sea. Thus, the raft presented her entire length to the force of the wind, with the inflated sides acting as a sail of sorts. About 18 hours after we went into the water, the wind shifted to the northwest and started driving us south. We were still in the hands of the fates and had to go with the winds. There were islands directly on our course now, but we were afraid the Japs had taken possession of these. We were not at all anxious to fall into their hands, as we believed they were in no mood to take prisoners of war, even castaways.